America.
This is Andy Richter on the Three Questions, which is a podcast, in case you hadn't figured it out. And I am talking today to Cola Scola, the very, very talented, hilariously funny character actor, cabaret star.
Thing. I'm a thing.
Bon vivant. Yeah.
Thank you. Hi.
Delightful toy for the eye and ear. I just made that one up. That was pretty
good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounded made up.
Well, they're all made up. They're words.
It's a first draft. Okay.
Words,
yeah, you're right. You're right.
You know. Well, where are you? Are you in your apartment in New York City?
I am. I'm in Cobble Hill. Gorgeous Cobble Hill.
And
should I give my address?
No. I don't think so. I mean, later,
okay.
Afterwards, after we stop recording,
okay.
I'd like to see it.
Street view? Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to just stand outside holding up a boombox, playing, I don't know. I haven't figured out what's really going to lure you out and into my heart.
Well, we can always add the audio after.
Absolutely.
And post.
Depending on what we can afford. Let's get into the the biographical stuff. You are a child of the Great Northwest. Is that not true?
I was. Yeah, that's true. Pacific Northwest.
And by the way, what is Escola? What is the derivation of?
It's Finnish.
Oh, really? Wow.
It was originally spelled with a K, but my grandfather changed it to a C to spite his father. That's the story my family tells.
Wow. That'll show.
Which makes me wonder if he's gay, because that's a pretty like petty gay person thing to do. Oh, maybe he's gay too. Like, maybe that's where I get it. Like, I'll show you.
Now, you have a famously tough childhood. You had a famously tough.
I love to talk about. About it as if it was like a made for TV movie. But it was like, you know, we were very poor. You know, we lived in a trailer and then into government housing. My dad was a Vietnam vet who was a raging alcoholic. And then my mother is a lovely alcoholic. But, you know, he was like, he chased us out of our trailer because he was hallucinating and thought the government was out after him. So and he had a gun it sounds, only now do I realize like how crazy it was. I remember as a child being excited when that happened because I was like, nothing ever happens around here. And
How old are you at this point?
Five.
Oh my
five
god!
Years old.
Oh wow! Yeah.
And I was like so thrilled that we got to like live with my grandma, and like, you know, my grandma and I like stayed in her guest room, and my mom and my brother stayed in my grandma's bedroom, and it was like I was like, yeah, grandma's my roommate. So you know.
Yeah.
It's for dramatic effect. I love to you know, well, and also like in therapy, I'm realizing those things do have an effect on you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's the thing. I mean, I've known, and especially being in comedy, we know so many damaged people that have made, you know, lemonade out of the lemons. And you can kind of, I think that minimizing your trauma is like A level coping.
Yeah.
That wasn't that big a deal. You know, when I saw mom hit dad or dad hit mom, I mean, mom hit dad actually probably short of an hour. But dad hit mom, you know, I mean, you think like, oh, okay, you know, it happens.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go to college or you get married and everything falls apart and you know, it's a time bomb. If you don't deal with it. You know?
If you don't deal with it and like. But I also, because I'm in, you know, we're in this business of show.
Oh, boy.
I often find myself, you know, narrativizing the story that way. Like, you know, can't pick myself up by my bootstraps. I came from nothing. We ate our toenails. We were so poor. and I'm just like. Also trying not to swing too hard that way and you know, like sort of masturbating the trauma.
Yeah,
if
yeah,
that
yeah.
makes sense.
No, that makes absolutely, because there are people yeah. that do that, and there are people.
And I would love to do that. That would make me feel so like a victim who needs a win, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm not the country singer that I wish
yeah,
I was.
Too much yeah. self-awareness is such a bummer.
I hate it.
When you have a pretty good idea of how you appear to other people, it yeah. really takes the fun out of so much.
Absolutely.
Now, there also, I imagine, too, because I know from dysfunction of my own family and
yeah.
my stepfather was an alcoholic and mm-hmm. it got very ugly. And yeah. when he left, it was like I sort of likened it, because up till then it was regular life, you know, it was
yeah.
regular life. But when he left, at the time, even I was kind of aware, and I think I was like 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. I said, it's like we were living for years with an air raid siren going off and someone yeah. turned it off. Like we yeah. had been used to this high level of stress and awfulness
mm-hmm.
and just kind of grew used to it. So then the absence of it wasn't like a big party. It was just like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
nice. That thing that was causing so much stress. And I don't mean that he was a thing, but I mean,
right,
you know,
right.
that factor in our lives that was so stressful is gone. And you know, now
yeah.
we can just be regular dysfunctional.
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you then stay with your grandma
we lived with my grandma for a while. Because what happened was like my mom got in a drunk driving accident where she was the drunk driver.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
This was before we left the trailer. Like, and then she had to go to rehab, which was, you know, a very memorable Christmas.
You mean because she wasn't yeah. there or because...
No, she got to come out for Christmas. And so that made it all the more special. like when I look back, like on my childhood memories, I'm like, wow, that was a great Christmas because we got to see Mom. And then I remember like, yeah, because she was taken away because she was in rehab.
Yeah,
like,
and she almost committed vehicular manslaughter.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah
exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Then after she got out, she went back. We moved back into the trailer, and that's when things. And then a few months later is when my dad did that stuff, and my mom was like, "I could do this when I was wasted, but like, I can't deal with this anymore."
Yeah.
So that's when
yeah.
we left for good. And then, you know, there's it was like low income housing, but like in a town of like 1,500 people. Low-income housing looks a lot different than it does, you know, in a major city. So it was like a white trash apartment complex.
Yeah.
You know, there was always cops there, like pulling like topless drunk women off of their, you know, like greaser boyfriends. We would often go into the dumpster to see like, they threw away this perfectly good coffee pot. You know,
yeah, yeah,
like fun things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you're very smart, very insightful, very funny. Is your family like? Are your folks smart, insightful, or funny, or are you like a unicorn?
they are funny and smart, like emotionally intelligent. I think being gay added an extra element of like outsiderness that maybe gave me a perspective that
yeah.
they just didn't have. But they like, you know, we still have the same sense of humor.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
yeah.
Like, they get it.
Yeah, which is, again, a really wonderful coping mechanism.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
And can be such a great collective one, so.
Yeah.
And are you in the same schools when this happens, or do you have to change towns?
Yes, same schools. And but, you know, in like, small towns like that, everyone, especially, like, really depressed, poor ones, like, everyone has, like, family, like, weird dysfunction, and everyone knows about everyone's.
Absolutely. You know. Yeah, no.
And did you grow up in a small?
Small-ish. Like a smaller, yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah. It was a town called Yorkville, which is west of Chicago. That was when I grew up there. It was, I mean, now it's kind of been absorbed by the suburban sprawl pushing outwards.
Yeah.
But when I grew up there, it was still pretty much the big, it was a farm town. And then there was also a Caterpillar tractor factory that employed a lot of people. So that was like, it was kind of a combo of that. And, but I mean, but also, you know, regular.
Yeah, our town was like built for a paper mill to exist.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the town had, it was just a farm town. And as things just got bigger, it got bigger. And when I was a kid, there were two traffic lights, I think, maybe three.
Yeah.
One at the end of town, one in the middle of town, and one at the other end of town. Mm-hmm. And when we got a McDonald's, people went and waited before 6 a.m. for it to open up. Like we were, I remember getting in.
We have the same thing for our first and only chain restaurant still in that town is Subway.
Yeah.
And the day it opened, it was like everyone in town, because it was like they were giving out free sandwiches on the first day. And so it was like, we'll wait for 7 hours for that $4.
Yeah, six inch. Right, yeah. Right. For that cold sub. Yeah. On yoga mat bread. But yeah, so that it was pretty small. It was pretty small. And there was a lot of the same kind of, I mean, it was, there was no, there were like maybe two rich people and they were, and they, two rich families, and they were wealthy people from Chicago that wanted to start horse farms. So they, you know what I mean? They moved out and they had. And
the American dream.
Yes, exactly.
Leave the city to start a horse farm.
To start your horse farm. Yeah, to you know, like to have these really expensive pets. And but everybody else, the closest, you know, was kind of middle class, you know. And but then there were also, there was the same thing. There were like, there were definitely kids that were, that who were very poor and, you know, and like there was a boy that I went to school with whose family lived in a house that his father had built, and they lived in a tent while he built the house, and their house was always heated by a wood stove. So he always, so everyone,
so he smelled like,
he smelled like a campfire all the time. And, you know, and just like that, that was kind of, you know, the thing. Or, you know, or just like the casual racism of people, you know, like kids at school saying the N-word just because
they thought it's shocking.
No, because they thought that's what black people called.
That's what people
That was the only word they ever heard in reference to black people, so you know, so would say it very matter-of-factly and be somewhat stunned when they were corrected. But yeah, it was kind of the same thing. But I mean, but my family was, because my grandfather, my mom's dad, was there from, actually his name was Glenn Palmer, and the Palmer land prior to that being Palmer land, his father's land, it was Blackhawk Indian land. So they were like the first white people to start a farm there. And he got a huge tract of land, and then it just it created a two or three generations of very lazy people, because all they did was they raised hogs and chickens for show and then sold land. They would sell off a big chunk of their farmland and then live on it for 5 years. You know, not live, but you know,
right.
But my grandpa, by the time he, you know, he was an adult. They'd run out of land. So he sold insurance, he sold real estate, and And, you know, and they just bought, he just sold, and he didn't have to sell it because people just liked him. So that, you know, it just was an income for him.
But, that's funny.
Yeah.
Like, sure, well, but hey, I like you.
All right.
I'll take an acre.
Yeah, I guess if I die, I want my kids to have some money. now, is being gay in that environment any different or any more difficult or easier than you think if you hadn't been in kind of under the stress of that, you know, poverty and.
You know, like all small towns, like where you know everybody, it's like pretty. This is a line from the Laramie Project, but like it's pretty much live and let live.
Yeah,
But truly, like people aren't like that's a gay guy. They're like, oh, that's Steve and Chris's son. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So, I mean, I think I felt more. Shame about it because of like cultural and, you know, societal implications than I did like being directly like made to feel unsafe. I mean, I was always called like fag or like, why do you act like a girl? And things like that. But I didn't really like, they didn't register to me as like insults.
You just get used to the abuse.
And also like everyone had their pejorative, you know, like, oh, she's slut, he's fat, that's fag, like everyone was like, it was just like no one was safe,
right yeah. It'd be great if, like, there was one kid that was just really kind, and that was his pejorative. Yeah, he's real fucking kind and nice.
Hey, yeah, you got some compliments for me today, Mr. Nice Guy?
Hey, I got problems. You want to understand them? I think, too, that I also think, too, that kid that the I have two kids. My son is gay. Mm-hmm. And I just, mm-hmm. and he came out to us when he was 11. And I just think it's just,
wow.
It's just an easier way. Yeah. And that isn't because of hooray for me and my ex-wife. It's just because we live in Los Angeles and there's no, you know, and like at my son's school, I had a dad once ask me about the school, and I think he was asking me, and he didn't know that my son was gay, but I think mm-hmm. he was asking me in coded terms about like, how will my gay son do at this school? You know?
Yeah.
But he was saying, he's like, he's a little bit different, you know, he's not like a jock or anything, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, and I just kind of cut to the chase. I didn't say, but I just said, I said, it's impossible to be a bully at my son's school. There's tolerance for it. There's, you know, and the kids even know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my son told me once when he was probably 12, 13, something like that. And he was at a table with a bunch of kids. And I don't think he'd made his sexuality known any more than 11, 12-year-olds have formed sexuality. They're all kind of gel-like at that age. But he said that he was at a table talking to some boys and that they started to say like, oh, that's so gay. Oh, that's so mm-hmm. fucking gay. And my son told me about, he said that he actually went like, what's wrong with gay? Like, do you have a problem with gay? And the boys were like, no, I guess not. And they're like, well, then why would you say it like that? And they're like,
yeah,
good point. You know?
Yeah.
I was so proud. I was so proud of him, you know, just to be brave enough to do that.
I think. I remember when I came out at 17, and I remember like one of the first times someone called me like as an insult called me gay, and I was like, yeah, I am, and they were just like, oh,
okay.
Like, because to them they are not thinking like they're gay and that's bad. They're thinking like, What's a bad word I can, what's something mean I can say?
Yeah, then, what's going to make them feel bad?
Yeah. And then I'm like, no, that's yeah, I am gay. And then they're like, oh, fuck, what else is there?
I know,
like,
I know. It's such a simple mechanism. Like,
yeah.
Like I remember years ago when there was, before there were sort of chat groups or Twitter, people had mm-hmm. these sort of like website email things where they would
yeah.
be just be an invited group of people. And there was one for comedy showbiz people. And mm-hmm. there was a guy who just had a baby. He's an actor, director guy. He had his first child, and somebody, and I think it was a gay person, when mm-hmm. he posted a picture of like the newborn, and it was a gay person that went like, oh my God, that kid is such a fag. Like about this newborn baby. And,
I think that's funny.
Oh, it's fucking hilarious. It's,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, like, and he got so mad. He got so
oh,
mad
no.
that he quit the no. thing. And like, and I saw him later and I was like, you know what? There's a good part, you know, that kid yeah. might be gay. So what's the big yeah. deal? Like,
yeah,
that's like saying, man, that kid sure is white. You know, it's like,
yeah. Or like, it's just funny to ascribe a personality
to a baby. Like, oh, it's the
to
best.
A baby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's
I
so
love,
funny.
I love saying things to like baby, like I mean, to just you know, like a, like to yeah. talk to somebody's baby and go like, this
he's
kid
toxic.
Is really fucking rude. Like, he won't even look me in the eye. Your kid's an asshole. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's yeah. You know.
It's one of the last few jokes.
Make fun of babies. They're the best.
To make fun of babies.
They're like, it's like making fun of cats. You know how you can
yeah,
like
exactly
a cutaway yeah. reaction shot of a cat. A baby's just the same thing. You know.
Yeah.
You're accused of murder, and then cut to this like day.
It's adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now are you did do theater pretty early, right? You knew that mm-hmm. like you were drawn to the stage.
Yeah. There was this I don't know if they even exist anymore, but there's this company called Missoula Children's Theater, and it would be two adult actors would come to town, and auditions were on Monday after school.
Already
the show was on.
This sounds really problematic. Is there a van?
The show was on Saturday. There yeah. there was. They lived out of it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, yeah, the auditions were Monday. The show was on Saturday. And
oh,
then they,
wow.
like, then the show was, you know, gone. And it was the best and most heartbreaking week of my life every year. Like, because that was all, you know, that was the only theater or anything that I was
sure.
interested in. Were those shows. And then on Saturday, like watching those adult actors leave and just being like, please take me with you. and now I think, God, I would never take that gig, but
yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I know.
But, it was really, that's how I got started.
Yeah.
Was Missoula Children's Theater. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you, like, are you coping very well during this time? I mean, you know, are you
yeah.
happy? Are you friendly? Are you got friends, you know?
I'm a big phone talker. I love talking on the phone. I love talking on the phone for, like, hours.
Yeah.
I love even just, like, sitting on the phone and watching TV and, like, forgetting I'm even on the phone. Like,
yeah,
that's just one of my...
It can be really fun.
Yeah.
And it seems so old-timey now. It's so
it
weird
does.
To talk to somebody on the phone now. It's...
Yeah. Yeah, it's so it's sort of a recent, like only in the past like 4 or 5 years that I've started doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really like. I feel like it's so weird when I'll talk to my friends. I'm like, you guys, you have to start talking on the phone. It's crazy. It's so fun. And people are like, just text me.
Yeah, I know.
But for me, I feel like texting is much harder. It takes longer. It's like whenever you're texting, it's always like you're stepping away from something else. And so it's like, you know, I'll be pressing play on a TV show, playing it for like 10 seconds, get a text like, oh, pause, or let me respond to this. And then like, it's just
yeah,
like
yeah.
a nightmare to me.
Yeah. I also think too, there's especially if something's more than
a question.
Meet me there at 3 or whatever, yeah. You know, simple.
Yeah.
I want to speak it because I think there's somewhere in my mind that pushing the buttons and texting is like manual labor. It's like work.
Yeah.
You know,
it does feel.
Whereas if I just talk to you, then we're just living and talking, yeah. And, you know, and sharing.
Yeah.
And yeah. But I also can see there are times there are people that where I feel like,
oh yeah.
Just text like, me. Please just text me. It's a lot quicker if you just text.
That's
me.
True.
Yeah.
I mean, I have like four, I have two people that I talk to every day, but maybe four friends in general that I talk to a lot on the phone.
Yeah.
And it's that's really like a tool that I've picked up, especially during this time.
I prefer it to Zoom. Because you can walk around. You don't have to worry how you look. You don't have to, you know.
Yeah.
If you're quiet, you can go to the bathroom, you know. Yeah. If you're careful. Yeah. You know?
If you're careful, like if you pee not on the water but on the and you sit down to pee and you pee on the
right
the,
exactly and if yeah. you and if you like
now if you gotta poop that's a risk.
It's a risk,
you don't know
but it can be done and it's depending on the person, you know, and you might have to
and hit, what you've eaten.
You might have to hit mute once or twice.
Yeah,
there's the you know you get all gathered you gather yourself. And then there's the flush and the dart, you know, like you flush and run. So like to get away from the sound of the flushing as quickly as you can.
I mean, I did it this morning before coming here. I was on the phone with a friend and I did the flush and dart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. That was a street sweeper.
Like what is that? Oh, the garbage truck is just, sorry, you were saying.
So,
but I love doing chores on the phone too. Like that, it really helps me to like anytime I have to do the dishes, I think, ugh.
Yeah.
Oh, but if I'm on the phone with someone, then it's like it almost feels like a group activity.
Yep. And that's where the headset. I see. I have the exact same headphones that you're wearing, and I when I'm on the phone, it's good because like especially talking to my mom, it's kind of like. It's like I got it, you know, she needs some time and I give her some time, but I get some stuff done during, you know, while I'm hearing the symptoms. So when do you head out on your own?
Well, I got involved in drama club and then and the drama club was run by this guy who worked at the mill all day.
Oh, wow.
And then would just volunteer like in the evenings, to like help us put on plays. And I'm like, I could cry thinking about that.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Guy,
what
just
a,
because like,
yeah.
Yeah. It just opened up my, you know, my whole world. That's like where I made like, my childhood best friends and that I still am in touch with. And so the town that I'm from is like 1500 people. There's a town 20 miles away, Longview, which is, you know, a bigger 20,000 people. That's where Walmart is. That's where the malls are.
Yeah.
That's like where you go if you want
similar
culture.
Similar situation with my town. We didn't go to Chicago. Yeah. We went to Aurora. And Aurora was like, it started as like a mill town because it had a river.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's like a medium sized. And now pretty depressed Midwestern city.
Yeah.
The notion of like going to the city to go shopping was, that meant Aurora. That was like, that's where the mall was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I ended up like. There were like summer camp theater programs there. And I did. Like a play there. It was sort of similar to Missoula Children's Theater in that there were two adult actors and then all the rest of the actors were kids. And one of the actors was this woman, an actress named Joan Menken, who lived in San Francisco and taught at a performing arts high school. And she invited me to come live with her and go to that performing arts school. In San Francisco.
Wow.
And my mom said no. And I was... I could have murdered her. But I mean, of course I understand why. But then sort of the compromise we made was that I got to move in with my cousin in Longview to go to a bigger school where they had theater classes and like they did musicals. Because in Klatskin, where I'm from, like we did plays, but we never did musicals. And like, so that was, I did that when I was 16. I moved out and sort of was half independent, half not.
Yeah,
you know, and then
were you happy with that, or was it tough? Like,
I loved it. Like looking back, there were like, I didn't have like role models for like being an adult. You know,
I know what you mean. Yeah,
yeah, they were all working. You know,
yeah,
like even my cousin was an OBGYN, like worked the night shift. So we never crossed paths, like, ever, really. And, like, so I didn't know that there was anything different, like, that there could be someone setting an example and helping me with things. But I was also, like, I don't think I wanted help. I was really independent and, like, fuck you! Like my cousin even, like, imposed... For the first time in my life, I had a curfew. Of 10 p.m. and my I did not take to that very well.
Yeah. Like
as soon as he left for work at 10:30 p.m. like I would come home at 9:55. As soon as he left for work at 10:30, I was out. Like
yeah.
I don't know where, like the grocery store with my friends to like buy bread because it was half off.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, like
yeah, there wasn't anything then, like, to do, yeah.
We would buy donuts and feed them to the ducks and thought it was hilarious that ducks were eating donuts. Like, that was the kind of, like, mischief we got into.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Fuck your curfew, man. We're feeding donuts to ducks.
Like, yeah, my brother and I have a brother that's 3 years older, and we never had a curfew, but all my brother's friends did. And what that amounted to was that when my brother was bored, he'd go home. And then his friends would end up coming with him and staying at our house until literal, like if it took 7 minutes to get home, it would be seven minutes before they had to be home. And as a child, it was like, oh, I see how this is dumb. You know, I mean,
unless it's arbitrary. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless your kid's a maniac, you know, who's a firebug or something, let him, you know. They're gonna. And also, I mean, as a parent, it's like you need to let them start self-regulating soon.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, early. And also, the one thing that I took out of my childhood that I tried to do differently is that just the feeling of like being listened to and being respected.
Yeah,
you know, like just not that feeling of just do it because I told you to. Like, here, I'll tell you why you got to do it. You know, like, or what do you want? And then listening to what you want and, you know, working something out.
I sort of had the opposite, which was like, do whatever you want. Just leave me alone.
Oh, really?
Like, just like, I'm tired. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
You know?
Like, it was that sort of thing. Like, okay, well.
All right.
I'll figure something out.
Fine. I guess you. I'll go get some donuts. Feed them to the ducks.
I was always trying to come up with ways to, like, make money before I was old enough to work. Like, my friends, I had, like, two friends, one who was also gay and one who was just really loud and everyone hated. And so she was, by default, like, with the gay guys. And the three of us would, like, we would go door to door asking if people needed anything, like, done.
Right.
Like, anything, like, for money. But my favorite enterprise we came up with was, like, it would snow, like, one or two days a year there, like, barely anything. But when it snowed, we would go door to door and offer to build snowmans in people's yards for money. As if, like, oh, thank God. Thank God. God, you can take that off my plate. Like,
our yard is so empty.
Yeah.
And I have all these carrots. Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Well, and so you graduate. Is there college in your future? Or
Well, yeah, I am. When I came out at 17, I made other like gay friends in this slightly bigger town, and then on weekends there was this underage club called The Escape in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
And so it was like an hour drive away, so we would go there, and that's when I met my first boyfriend. And he lived in Portland, and he would drive down to Longview every Friday after school, pick me up, take me to Portland, and drive me back on Sundays, like at, in the evening. But
Yeah.
like, so he was a year ahead of me in school, and he went to NYU. And so I had, I'd always wanted to live in New York, but it was just like, it never occurred to me that I could. Like, it
Yeah,
was
it's
just
like
like,
living on the
huh, seems
moon.
nice.
Yeah, it's
Yeah. Yeah. Like, how do I even get that? Like, how do I even buy a plane ticket? But being, so alone and codependent and very, like much in love, like a teenager in love in this relationship, it was like, I will find a way to be near him. And like, thank God, because that's what led me to New York, and that's when I came here. And I went to school for a year. I lived at the 92nd Street Y. That's where the school's dorms were for some reason. And we got to see the lectures for free. So I was, that's how I met Marion Seldes.
Oh, well, that's
Joanna
nice.
Gleason,
And
sure.
I imagine that as most Ys are, it's a hotbed of sex, right?
Yes,
Oh
the
yeah.
92nd Street
It's just an
Y.
ongoing orgy,
Yes.
with
With all the great
Andrea
Jewish
Dworkin
intellectuals.
showing in up, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now, did you drop out of high school, or you mean after you graduated as a
After I
senior?
graduated as a senior, I applied to every school in New York. I went to the one that accepted me,
Which
Marymount
was?
Manhattan
Okay.
College. And I went for a year. I liked it. I didn't know what I wanted to do. It was insanely expensive. I couldn't even afford to take out like my like we got rejected for loans, and so like there was just no way for me to keep going. So my options were like move back home and like go to a, state school or a community college, or like go back to New York and just like work.
Become a cabaret star.
Become a cabaret star. And so that's what I did.
So, and is there any pushback from anybody that to stay home, or they're just like,
No.
you're grown and you're up and you're out and
Again, it's like it was just like leave. I don't. We can't afford. Leave me alone. Like I don't know what to tell you. I can't afford it. Like, but I love you, and have fun.
Do you, was part of it like was your gayness too much? Was it kind of just like, I
It
don't
was too
know.
much for me. Like everyone else was like fine with it. It was just like I was going crazy. I was like, and especially after then being in New York for a year, like the thought of going, from New York back to Clatskanie, Oregon, it was like there's no way in
I
hell.
can't even imagine.
So then I came back and I was miserable for many years, and then now I'm here.
Not miserable. Just this morning, it changed.
It clicked. I finally
Now
got that 8 hours I needed.
What do you, I mean, do you come back and is it just like, well, let's see how it goes? Are you still with your boyfriend at this point?
No. We broke up before I even got to New York.
Oh my
But I
gosh.
had been accepted into the school, so I was like, well, I guess it's, yeah, I guess I'll just follow through with it.
And also it's New York still. I'm sure that you were excited about that.
Yes,
Was
yeah.
it
So I.
was that transition difficult? Was like Clax
No.
whatever to what is it? How is it? How do you say it?
Klatskanie, Klatskanie.
Clatskanie was
Birthplace of Raymond Carver, correct.
I was gonna Raymond Burr?
Raymond Burr, yeah. No.
Clatskanie to
Klatskanie,
Longview to New York. Do you get to New York and are you frightened? Are you
Well, as I'm sure you know, like you might be somewhat familiar with the Upper East Side. Like,
yes.
It's not exactly like a, oh my God, I'm overwhelmed. Like,
yeah.
And because the school was on the Upper East Side, and, you know, you just never think to, like,
go
venture
further.
Out of the little, you know. I mean, even now, I haven't been to Manhattan since March, like, because of the pandemic, and I don't need to.
Right.
So, like, it was just like it felt right to me. I was like, yeah, everything's open 24 hours.
Yeah.
Just like me.
Right.
And it's
the Upper East Side, so there's lots of elderly people.
There's
which
lots
you're used
of
to.
Fun elderly people.
Yeah, yeah. Some pretty good German restaurants. Or at least there used to be. I don't know. There's a lot of them.
I don't think there are anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of bridge and tunnel-y.
Like, is it?
In terms of the nightlife scene. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so when you get back, what do you stay in that neighborhood? What?
I moved to Spanish Harlem with some other people that were that I had met through college. And I worked at a children's bookstore for like wages that like no one should have to live off of. And, you know, you know, you're young and not that I'm old, but like, you know, I was 19. So it was, it felt normal to me to like walk 103 blocks to work to save the $2. So that I could buy falafel afterwards, you
know? Right. It is. Yeah. And how do you start performing in New York? How do you kind of get into that?
That
wasp's nest.
Well, I never considered that I could be a performer. Like, as soon as I got to New York, I was like, you know, because all I really saw of performance was like the theater program at this college. And college theater programs are not very enticing. They weren't very enticing to me. I was like,
I agree.
That's not something I want to be a part of.
I always, you know, Charles Grodin, who's, I mean, take whatever you want about Charles Grodin, but he wrote a very funny, his first memoir, but he recounted going to theater classes and like being, so, the teachers just being infuriated because he constantly would say, why? Like, they would give an exercise and he'd be like, why? What does that have to do with learning lines? What does that have to do with knowing blocking? And the few theater, I'm making air quotes, classes that I took, I was so struck by that. Like, why are we doing this?
Yeah, it seemed very cult-like to me.
Yeah.
Like, one of the, I did a show there through a student theater production because it was the only way I would be allowed. Like, I didn't want to go home for the winter holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to stay in the dorm. The only way I could do that was to either take a class and it was too late to enroll or be in some sort of production.
Yeah.
So I auditioned and I was like, I need this job. And,
you don't understand.
Yeah. But I was just really like confused by like all of these weird rules that like everyone had agreed because of like one guy, like the head of the theater department was like, oh, you're like, don't ever look up. like that. I remember that was one of the rules. Like, don't ever look up. Don't look up.
On
like,
stage?
You can, like, look. Yeah. Yeah. Like, don't look up. I don't remember why. I'm sure he had like some explanation, but like, I just remember thinking like, I don't like theater. I don't like performing.
Yeah, yeah. And also, a good thing to do when I'm getting on stage, especially, you know, like not being that used to being on stage, is to fill my head with a lot of bullshit chores. You know, like,
yeah.
What does
it
that
felt
do?
Very like stifling and constricting and like, So
I also think there's an aspect to, and it's the way people who are in teaching people how to act in that kind of more classic kind of way, I think that their rationale for it and the way that they would defend themselves is that it's getting you out of your head. Like, having you be a tree or embody the notion of, you know, whatever, you know, hunger. get on stage and be hunger. You know, I think it's just to make you forget about yourself.
But it can have the opposite effect.
And I also think about, and this is just from my experience with acting, and my acting is that I've done is almost all film and television acting.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't forget about yourself. Like you got to kind of like you need to be in control of yourself and think about what you're doing and make choices, not just be like some free flowing thing. And that was always, and it also felt very mind fucky and very like I had so many, there were so many sort of teachers that were teaching acting that it just felt like you just like telling kids what to do. And it always, it always seemed like it was kind of creepily sexually charged of, you know,
Or even just like political, like you will not get the lead this year. Like it was very political, and it was like she promised me if we did Wild Party that I would get to play Queenie.
Yeah,
and like you know, like, and then she did that to teach you a lesson about expectations. And it's like, what are you?
I learned.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, why do you need this little puppet theater? Right. Of humans.
Right. Yeah. We're not writing a play. We're performing plays.
Right.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? So anyway, New York, you start performing. Yeah. What? How do you get performing, the nerve?
I started making YouTube videos with a friend of mine. Uh-huh. And that was, and he was really like the motivate, like my friend Jeffrey Self, who would, he would be like, come over, let's do this, and I would just, and then we were just having fun, making YouTube videos.
What year
then
is this?
Then we thought, this was 2007.
Okay.
And then we were like, we need to, like, what, maybe we can make money if we do, like, a live show.
Yeah.
And so we started performing in the basement underneath the Daryl Roth Theater in Union Square, and we did, like, a live show, like a live sitcom sort of thing. And then we did a show at Joe's Pub, and then executives from Logo, the Logo Network, happened to be there, and they were like, basically said, we want you to like make something for us. And they asked us to make like 30-minute vlogs for their like website. And we said like, we'd rather, we were like, let's make a sketch. Let's make a sketch show. So we like, filmed it all on, you know, the laptop camera, and edited it in iMovie. Like, you know, costumes were like a jacket as hair.
Yeah,
you know, like children playing around. And we turned it in, and they were like, great, we love this, we're going to put it on the air. And so we got a, we had a sketch show on Fridays at midnight on Logo.
Do they give you more money, or did they just?
No.
Yeah, yeah, that's not fantastic. No. I
we
knew
made
it. Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
$1,000 total for 6 episodes of television.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
Shame on you, Logo. Shame on you.
In their, I don't want to say defense, but like the next season, we then had like a more normal television deal. Like, but we were so excited. We'd never done anything before. And like, I wouldn't change it. Like I would still take that $1,000 and be like, you know what? This is actually a good start. And this will be more valuable than.
I understand that side of it, but still they know better.
Yeah.
They know better. That's
shitty. They knew that. Yeah. We felt that way. So when they were like,
when they hire you to do a vlog, and then they get this, they're not naive. They're sitting in that room looking at this stuff and going, holy shit, this is arable. Wowie, what a bargain we just made.
Yeah.
Because don't tell these young, impressionable, hungry kids that they deserve more, you know?
Yeah.
We did it after I worked with the Real Life Brady Bunch, which is run by Jill Soloway, who's now Joey Soloway, and his sister, Faye.
Yeah.
We did this pilot for MTV, a sketch comedy. There was just a bunch of us from Chicago that had been together at the Annoyance Theater and Brady Bunch. And they paid us so little. And we had no, like, we had no leverage in the thing or anything.
Yeah.
And the deal going forward for all of us, no, I thought maybe 9 or 10 of us. I realized, like, if this show gets picked up, I'm going to have to bartend. And I'm going to very potentially be standing behind a bar with the sketch show that's on a national network behind me. And people will be like, when did you do that? And like, oh, no, I actually have a 6 a.m. call time tomorrow.
Yeah, that's and how it was.
Yeah.
I was working at the day the show premiered, I had to pick up a shift at the bakery. And I remember feeling like sort of like enjoying the fact that it was like unjust in my mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, wow, here I am in this bakery, and little do these idiots know that I have a television show premiere tonight.
I shouldn't be covered in flour, I should be covered in glitter.
Exactly. And but then, you know, then that begot like, you know, more performance connections and blah, 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 you know, slowly and surely a career happened.
Yeah. And also, well, you also, I think, because you are such a funny person and such a talented person that
you
get to meet, you're welcome. You get to, you know, then you're like, you become pals with Bridget Everett, and you become pals with Amy Sedaris, and you get, you know, and that's how like the happiest kind of show business happens, you know?
Yeah. Because Bridget, I met early on, and I think I first met her at this show that she did at a gay bar on Sunday nights.
Yeah.
Very hopping for a gay bar. It was during a blizzard. And me and Jeffrey and our friend who was the DJ were the only people there. And she still did her songs. And it was like, I just remember being like, wow, this lady is, I want to be her friend.
Oh, she, it's a cliche, but force of nature. Yeah. She's really there. She is 100% herself. You know, and that's great.
Yeah. Horrible person.
Listen,
horrible person.
I know.
No, she doesn't tip.
Puts cigarettes out in journalists' ears. How does that transform into then you like doing a solo show? Like, because your show, I'm Stuck. That was the one.
Yeah, that
and was
I,
that
I
at
started,
Joe's Pub?
No, I started doing that at the Duplex.
Okay.
And it was like, it was after Jeffrey, after two seasons of our, lo-fi sketch show, he moved to LA. And then doing stuff with him, I had never performed on my own before. And so I, for a few years, I sort of floundered. I did some regional theater. I did some cabaret, but I really don't like singing. And I think singing is embarrassing.
Yeah.
Or it makes me feel embarrassed. I mean,
No, I know.
I don't watch people sing and go like, oh my God.
I feel the same way about like real acting. Like when I have to be like, say a line that I just think is like that. Whenever I've done drama. Yeah. I've done good drama, not a lot of drama, but there's been some like just regular old TV drama that I've been in that I feel is like so much more embarrassing than like showing my asshole, you know,
to a
group of senior citizens.
Absolutely. Then like cry and say like, mom just died. Like I would rather the asshole.
Yeah. Exactly. So then you get back to New York and you decide I'm going to, you know.
Well, I was here, and then I just knew that there was something like I just felt like I know I can do something that I'm not doing right now. Like I know, but I couldn't find anywhere to do it. Like for some reason, like Second City and things like that, or Upright Citizens Brigade all seemed again, like that same mentality of like, oh, that they wouldn't take me. So let's figure something else out.
Yeah. But do you really think they wouldn't? Do you really think they wouldn't take you? Or do you think?
Well, no, they would take anyone who could pay the price of admission.
Right.
But like, and maybe I would have like loved it and like blossomed, but it just didn't seem like, because I didn't have any connections there. And at this point, all of my work and stuff came from like, just like my friends that I was having fun with.
Yeah.
I was like, I just decided to challenge myself, to write, an hour long show, a new hour every month. And that's sort of how I started.
Wow.
Finding my, what I like to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's it. That's to make that challenge of yourself is really, admirable.
It was one of like the, funnest times. Like, I think on my deathbed, I'll be thinking about those performances more than, you know.
And when you put that pressure on yourself and that deadline on yourself, talk about taking the pressure off. Like, you have no choice. Yeah. Like, you got to, you know, you got to make the donuts, you know, that, you know.
Yeah. It was also like, I decided to do it because the duplex let you keep it, 100% of the door. They just made money off of the two-drink minimum.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, okay, if I charge, you know, $8 and there's 70 people, like, that's a little something to help with rent. Like,
yeah.
It was also because I had done shows other places and I, you know, there's always a door split and I would, you know, get the check and I would be like, huh?
I know.
Wait, it was sold out. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And I can buy a pizza?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was one aspect of it that I enjoyed. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And then, that led to like, you know, after doing that for like 3 years, I had all this material, most of it not good, but like I had enough to like create a good show that I was proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a show that I did it at Joe's Pub, and then I took it on tour, and then I sort of went for my B-sides and created a new show out of that.
Yeah.
And then I recently in quarantine I filmed a special by myself and put it on YouTube.
And is that stuff from the shows?
Yeah. That's okay. All from the shows.
Oh, okay.
And it's
holy shit, that was funny.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. I think I saw it the night it came out or something, and my kids and I all, the three of us watched it.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
It was so, so funny. And
thanks.
And the closing number, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but they should look it up. and just as they say, watch to the end, because the closing number, I think we rewound and watched it 5 times. You know?
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really, it's really like something I'm really proud of, because it's, when I was doing the show, I wanted to, I was like, I'd love to preserve this somehow.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel right to film it, because on stage, I'm in my underwear, I'm doing the costume changes, like, in front of people.
Right.
It's very, like, messy. And something about, like, filming a stage version of it felt, like, unbelievable. Like, it would be too, like, well, you clearly had a budget to film this. Why are you doing it like this?
I understand that, yeah.
And so then when the lockdown happened, I was like, oh, it actually would make much more sense if I filmed this all by myself in my apartment.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I feel really good about like that. I can be like, here's the proof of the work that I did for these years.
And it also has helped because the circumstances of it, like you said, in this case, the circumstances are a direct link to the motivation of the thing, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas you're right. If you're like, there's so many things that you see, it's like, well, why are, you know, like you have money, you can, you know, you don't need to do this.
I'm not buying that.
Yeah. It's like, it's just not. Yeah, exactly. I don't buy that. That's like such a bottom line thing of what my main critique with so much of show business is like, I don't buy that. With people stand up. I don't buy that.
Yeah.
It just takes me out of it. And then
I'm bad at stand up. Because I feel like I'm too honest.
Yeah.
And I hate repeating myself.
I do too.
And so when I tell a story, I'm a terrible storyteller because I'm like, so the other day, I guess this was, Like a month and a half. Oh, God, no. Wait, yeah, yeah, when was mom's birthday was? Okay, so 2.5 months ago, you know, and it's just like, they don't care about those fucking details.
I know.
In my brain, I'm like, tell the truth, Cole. That's a lie. Yeah, like, you know, yeah.
Well, and I have that compounded with improv training, mm-hmm. which is it's macho Chicago improv training, Del mm-hmm. Close improv training, which is you, if you say it once, you shouldn't say it again.
Like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You came up with a character that was, and in many ways, it's almost adolescent in its anti-commercialism. You know, like you came up with a great character. Now you can't do it again. I mean,
yeah.
And if you're just going to be doing shows in Chicago, okay. But out in the real world, like, no, if you come across something good,
I know.
Make
I
it
remember
work.
Seeing when I saw like one of my successful friends doing material that I'd already seen and it killing. And it being better than the time before when I had seen it, I was like, you're allowed to to do it twice?
Yeah.
Like, or 300 or 400 times.
Yeah. The time when it really got in the way of my life was when I started working and then I would have to do press things. And you get asked, especially like junkets for a movie where you go and it's 2 days of the same questions over and over and over. And I would say, I would tell, you know, they'd ask me, like, how was it on set or whatever? How did it come to this? And I would have a story. And then the next fucking dipshit would come in and be like, so tell me how this happened. And I would, feel like, well, I have to say it different.
And I know.
It took, you know, a couple of years where I'm like, stupid. Say the same shit. What the fuck? Say the same shit. Nobody ever sees this stuff, you know?
Right, like, right.
You know?
No one sees it. It doesn't, even if they did, they wouldn't be like, hey,
right.
He said it was fun on set twice.
Right, exactly.
What an asshole.
Yeah.
Hack.
I know.
Yeah, I totally understand, like, you're just not wanting to repeat yourself. But also I wanted to say, like, the other thing that I loved about doing the special in your apartment is not only was it sort of like made complete artistic sense in COVID why you did it, it was extra crazy. It made it was like it gave this whole air of like Miss Havisham insanity to the whole thing, which was so fantastic. And I mean, because that's kind of even on stage, it kind of has a bit of a like a performing a monologue for yourself kind of thing.
When I was my mom got me one of those, you know, tape recorders with a microphone attached, and I would just lock myself in my bedroom and talk and sing and make up stories into it, sometimes with a tape in there recording it, most times not. It just like, I loved hearing my voice come out of that tiny little speaker, and that has always been like the feeling that I sort of chase when I'm performing or that I like to like,
I can see that.
Cause it's the most fun for me.
Yeah.
And if it's fun for me, then, you know.
Yeah. And also
someone might like it.
Your two sort of most indelible television characters are your character on Difficult People. Mm-hmm. And then Cassie on Amy Sedaris' show.
Yeah.
And those both are so fucking funny and must be so much fun to play for kind of different reasons. And I mean, they're both sort of self-involved assholes.
Yes.
But, you know,
which is always fun to play.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah. But like, especially, what was the name of your character on Difficult People?
Matthew.
Holy shit. Matthew was like the worst person on earth.
Worst person. And it was like, I'm always auditioning for like the gay role, the gay receptionist, excuse, who are you here to see?
Yeah.
Like, and this was sort of this character, it was safe to play up the stereotype of that because, the character was awful and there were other gay characters in the show. So it wasn't like I had to be the sole,
safe space. You're not carrying all of homosexuality on your shoulders. Yeah.
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 It was through a very like self-aware lens. And so it was fun to just wear a Boy from Oz show jacket and like flip my scarf in people's faces.
Yeah. And never do any work, you know?
And never do any work.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I love workplace comedies where it's like, I also love too
that like, and it's just like some of the best characters. It sort of, for me, like all of Chris Elliott's career was the absolute useless idiot who is the high status character of the whole thing. You know, like he's like in his, like, and you were that character. He's, he's the highest status person there. No one can tell him what to do. And, and he's just a waste of space.
Yeah.
In terms of every other character's life, he's just this, like, he's an amusement, but mostly he's kind of like at times even gets in the way of the forward progress of the group.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So funny. And that's, and Julie wrote that for you, kind of. Julie and Billy wrote that for you?
Julie wrote it. Julie and I got the part because I happened to be in LA when they did a table read. And I'm not sure if she wrote it with me in mind, but
somewhere in my research it said that. It said that.
Maybe I think I've heard her say that too, and I'm just being modest and saying no, I'm sure she couldn't have written it.
She might be lying.
She might be lying.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? She's a liar. I'm calling her out here. I want to start a feud right now
with Julie Klausner.
With Julie about whether or not she wrote that part with me in mind.
Well, she knows how delicate you are.
Yeah.
That you need, how much you need.
Yeah. But that was fun. And that was like the first time I got to be in a writer's room too on that show. And
that's great. Then,
yeah. Yeah.
What was that like? How was that? Cause I mean, you'd worked with Jeffrey, you know, kind of collaboratively and was that kind of it? Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. And then, you know, everything seems so intimidating until you get in there and you realize, oh, this is just people.
Yeah.
Like, these are just people doing that. Like, you know, you get a finished script and you look at it and it's all formatted correctly. And you're like, all these abbreviations, like, oh, why is cut two on the other side of the page? Like, and you think like, I don't know any of that. I can't be a writer. And then you get in and it's like, the writers don't even do the formatting.
You don't
and it's
have
like
to,
people coming up with ideas. Yeah. So that was an eye-opening experience.
It's also for me, like, one of the primal reasons for doing what, like, sit around, be funny with funny people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck? And get paid for it, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, and that's not to be Pollyannish because you're creating a product.
Sure.
And, you know, but it is like, wow, it's just, and so much fun, you know?
Yeah. When I got like writing on Amy's show, like almost every night I would leave that room and I would go like, wow, I just got to spend hours laughing with like one of my heroes. Like that's incredible.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you see life? I have a hard time seeing life past COVID. I think about like what it's going to be and what my plans are and there are days and I'm like, I am going to come out of this thing guns blazing. Look out, Hollywood. And then there's other days where I just think like, well, maybe I'll just retire, you know?
My mind is in retirement right now. I'm looking at, I can't afford to buy anything, but I'm looking at real estate in the Scottish Highlands. I'm looking at castles for sale. I really am, every day.
Are they
cheap?
I'm
like, well.
Are they cheap?
You could buy a castle there for the price of a house in L.A.
Wow.
Like, you know, 1.2 or like, you know.
But there's no plumbing and it's 6 hours from a grocery store.
Absolutely. But like how because my fantasy is buying a castle in the Scottish Highlands, you know, like and inviting people to like, oh, I have this place in the country, come stay with me. It's cute, this cute little place, like there's space for you. And then having them come up a 2-mile driveway to like a castle and acting like, oh, I'm sorry, it's a little cold, but
yeah. You know. And then just huge herds of miniature ponies running around.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Every room covered in mirrors.
Yes. Yeah. But that's really like, I really can't picture between next year and 10 years from now. Like my mind is, or 10 years, like I'm going to retire at 43.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd love to, but that's where my brain is going right now.
Are you working on things? Scotland. I mean, are you?
Sort of.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was working on things before this started, and then like writing projects that came to a stopping point, and it's, you know, I could work on something. I'm mostly watching a lot of lectures on historical. I'm watching a lot of historical lectures. Like I'm watching a 24-part lecture on the year 1215 right now.
Wow. You jerk off to weird stuff.
I do. I certainly do. And you bet I don't come until they mention the Fourth Lateran Council. Absolutely not. I wait.
How do you decide, like, how does this start to happen that you're watching these incredibly minute, detailed lectures?
It's just like, you know, it's like, I love The Crown. I love a boring mood, like historical period thing. And then, you know, I run out of The Crown. I watch Wolf Hall. I run out of those episodes. I'm looking for other similar things. I watch a documentary on YouTube. Then I find there's a lecture series on the year 1066 on this website, The Great Courses Plus. So I watch that. And then, you know, then I'm like, this is really comforting to watch. It's The Great Courses Plus is like if Masterclass didn't fuck or have nice clothes. It's,
yeah.
Whereas Masterclass is very like slick and sexy.
Yeah, there's lots of editing tricks and stuff. Yeah.
Editing tricks. The Great Courses Plus is a camera in a room with a college professor who has never been more excited to talk to you about the Norman conquests.
Yeah, yeah.
And they shouldn't be on camera. This person should not be ever be on camera. They're stumbling over their words, but it's endearing and it's like they love what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And so, and I don't remember any facts. Like, I'll maybe remember two facts every, like,
that's what I was going to ask, because I don't think I could. Yeah.
But I feel when I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, now I know that. I'm
quite
smart. Look at me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'll show those people about that who talk about not going to college. I'm going to college right now.
Yeah.
At the University of COVID.
Yep.
Well, so, because that's kind of, you know, the gimmick of this thing and the three questions is like, you know, where are you going? And I mean, but I feel like the world's on pause, you know? So,
and also, I was talking to Amy and she was saying like, this is the time to explore. And you know, like there are times when I feel creative bursts. I felt one when I made that special. And now I feel like I'm collecting information that, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, but I just have to follow what I like and trust that eventually I'll be like, oh, I'm going to write a sketch show about the plague or, you know, something.
Yeah,
and then
all of
that information will come in handy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is, I don't want to keep any more. This has been really delightful.
Thanks.
I'm so glad we got
for me too.
Yeah, I'm so glad we got this extended chance to talk, because I really have been enjoying your stuff for as long. And I never saw the logo show, so I have to go back and watch some of those. That would be,
it's almost unwatchable.
Is it really?
It's hard to find. Well, the quality is just so bad. And
right.
It's like, because it was, we didn't have sound, we didn't have equipment. And,
yeah.
But
like
fun.
the sound is bad and stuff like
yeah,
that.
The sound is really bad and it's like, ouch. It hurts.
Well, I think it'd be, I mean, you know, I don't dare. I will. You can't stop me from watching what I want. What do you think the point of all of it is? You know,
don't talk to strangers. That's how things get
weird.
I don't know. I don't know what the point is, except to keep watching that lecture series.
Well, I mean, do you have like a philosophy? Do people talk to you and say, like, you know, what's your advice? What do you, you know, I mean, whether it's professional, whether it's personal, or
I feel like I don't know. It always feels masturbatory to be like, this is the quality I love about myself. But yeah, like, one thing that I'm like relieved I have is like, I really am the most important barometer for myself in terms of like the work that I create. Like, I, you know, I've put out stuff in the past couple years that like, I just like wasn't that happy with. And like, I don't know, like it's just so, you know, the special that I made, like, it's not like it blew up or like it's getting me millions of jobs, but like I'm so proud of it that I'm like, I know that like that is like, I'm just so pleased that it turned out the way that I had hoped it had turn out when I started it. And that is, so I'm so glad that I have that. I'm, my main goal is always to fulfill like myself, I think, I hope.
I, you know, as somebody who's 20-ish years older than you, if not, how old are you?
7. 33.
33. I knew it. Yeah. Same age as Jesus when he died. I am 20 years older than you. And I will tell you, the fact that you are coming upon that notion of, I did this thing, it was a lot of work, and, you know, it's not setting the world on fire, but I'm really proud of it. And it's, and it's not like it was a failure. You know, I mean, it's,
no.
People saw it will have,
it exists forever online. It's not like, you know,
and there are people that saw it that will give you jobs. There are people that saw it that will want to work with you. And there are people that saw it that will then see something else that you're in and go, oh, I remember that. That's that guy that did that YouTube special in his apartment. And it will matter. But the main thing is that you just like, you spent some of your time on earth doing something that was fruitful and satisfying and fulfilling to you. And that the fact that you're coming on that you figured that out at 33, and it, you know,
means I can retire at 43.
No, I don't think you should. I don't think you should. I think you're going to, you know, because you're going to get to the end of those lectures and then what?
You're right. Well, I need to learn how to season a cast iron skillet. That's next on the list.
That's easy. You
say that.
In a 350 degree oven, you take the skillet, you cover it with, it could be a light coating of, well, you can do it on the stove. You start with shortening, or I like to use ghee because I'm a big adherent of ghee. Kind of coat the inside of it, get it coated, dump out any excess, and then put it in that put a sheet of paper towels or a pan underneath it and heat it upside down in that 350 degree oven for half an hour or more.
Okay.
And then that will create the seasoning, and then you just don't scrub it with abrasives, and you don't wash it with soap.
Right.
So.
Then now I am done. I don't know what else after the lecture then.
Go back to college. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Get your degree at something.
Yeah.
You know. Floral arranging.
Thank you. Yeah.
Highlight. there's so many things.
Yeah.
Well, Cola Scola, thank you so much
for taking
some time and being on and gracing this podcast with your, it's not really wisdom, I guess. Your
joie de vivre.
Yeah, your joie.
Yeah.
Your joie. Yeah. You're just your general joie. Your joie générale.
Thank you. And please come up to the castle.
I will. Sometime. I will. Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm going to bring some really obnoxious friends with me. I'm going to trash that fucker.
I can't wait. Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope that we can get together face to face at some point soon. And I hope, you know, nothing but the best for you. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Andy.
And thank all of you out there for listening. And we will get back at you next time with 3 questions.
Got a big, big love for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galitza Hayek, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.